Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
And welcome you are, the best audience in the world, the best certainly in the field of psychiatry, psychology, human services, therapy, self-help, anything to do, anything touching on mental health. There are no better folks. And increasingly, I'm going to be having people on about physical health, too. I've been developing my own interests in that area that I'll be sharing with you over time. Don't forget, of course, that we are archived, as are all the shows, on PRN. I'm so glad to be affiliated with PRN. And the station, PRN.FM. Don't forget that on Bregan.com, we now have the new Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center. Probably 150 scientific articles categorized, set up so you can search them. Introductory comments by myself on this dreadful disorder of abnormal movements that actually involves much more than just odd, uncontrollable, sometimes disabling movements. It also involves hazards to the brain and mind as well. A real destroyer of quality of life, and very common. All the antipsychotics cause it. Very important for you to know about this. And it joins my ECT Resource Center, which is a separate website, but we're also going to have that soon included on our Bregan.com, but right now it's a separate ECT Resources Center. .com.org. Today, I have the kind of guest I really enjoy having. Now, none of my guests are generic or belong to a particular kind, but there are some folks who, out of sheer heroic determination, show that an individual can impact on the world. This seldom happens from professionals. I think it more often happens from people who develop a personal interest in reform. And Kim is a really startling individual. I chatted with her for half an hour. Our paths have crossed at FDA hearings. Our paths have crossed around issues. But we've never actually, as far as either of us could remember, sat down and talked for even 15 or 20 minutes. Her name is Kim Witsak. Kim, am I pronouncing your last name right?
You are. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Witsak. Let me spell it for the world. W-I-T-Z. W-I-T-C-Z-A-K. W-I-T-C-Z-A-K. Witsak. Kim, I'll let her tell you in a minute about how she got involved in becoming a consumer advocate, a public advocate surrounding healthcare and especially psychiatric drugs. What's important is she did not come at it professionally. She'll tell you a little bit about her background, but she has had a huge impact on this area. She's been covered in all kinds of media, including the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. She's been involved, as I have, in documentaries. She's testified before Congress. She's now a part of the Consumer and Public Health Coalition. I'm going to let her tell you about this. This is D.C.-based. But most interesting, startling, using that word again, she has made herself into and has become the consumer representative on the FDA Psychopharmacologic Drug Advisory Committee. That committee that meets to advise the FDA on how best to make the public secondary and industry first in everybody's mind and heart, Kim sits there. Now, you'll learn that it isn't without hazards to be there. I actually learned a lot from talking to Kim briefly on the phone. So, Kim Witsak, welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be on your show. I've been a huge fan of yours for years. So it's actually fun to finally sit down and at least by phone talk with you.
Tell us how you got into this arena. And by the way, I'm so pleased that I played a role. As so many people, folks, you've heard this again and again, folks I've never talked to before, and it turns out that the work I did, often many years ago, was helpful. At my age, this kind of legacy is deeply meaningful. And the book that Kim read was the Antidepressant Fact Book that opened her eyes or helped open them up. Quite often is toxic psychiatry. So, Kim, give us your background, how you got involved in this work. I want to hear about the FDA committee work. You've got a lot to share with us.
Sure. Well, first of all, my background is, ironically, I'm in advertising. And 13 years ago, my life looked very different than it does today. I was married to my best friend, Woody. I had a successful career in advertising, traveled the world on productions, planning to start a family. However, all that changed with one phone call on August 6, 2003. My world as I knew it came crashing down. Woody, my husband of almost 10 years, was found hanging from the rafters of our garage, dead at age 37. As you can imagine, this was completely shocking to me, especially because Woody wasn't depressed, nor did he have a history of depression or any other mental illness. You know, Woody was an outgoing, gregarious person, had a huge personality. He had just started his dream job as vice president of sales with a startup company and was having trouble sleeping, which is not that uncommon for entrepreneurs, as you know, and when you're starting your own business, you know, sometimes you wake up in the middle of the night. So he went to his family doctor, who he loved and trusted and believed in, and was given Zoloft, you know, the antidepressant off-label for an insomnia diagnosis. The doctor told him that the drug would help take the edge off and help him sleep. However, 5 weeks later, Woody was dead. And ironically, the three-week sample pack that Woody had gotten automatically doubled the dose from 25 to 50 milligrams. And at the time, there was no cautionary warning to look for anything. And, you know, about these drugs, never told him to look for anything, me. And, in fact, I was out of the country on an advertising shoot in New Zealand when he first got put on these drugs. So I wasn't there to see any of him, you know, basically falling apart. But I did have an experience when I got back from New Zealand. One day I was pretty excited to see him, and he came walking through our back door. He had a blue dress shirt on and completely sweat through his shirt, his undershirt, and his blue dress shirt. Dropped his bag at the back door, sat down in the kitchen floor in a fetal position and his hands around his head and like a vice. And he goes, "Kim, you got to help me. I don't know what's happening to me. It's like my head's outside my body looking in. You got to help me." And at that time, you know, to be honest with you, I didn't have any experience with these drugs or these type of drugs. And I remember we calmed him down. We got him to breathe. You know, we did yoga breathing. We prayed. And the next day he called his doctor and said, you know, told him about it. And the doctor said, "You got to give these kind of drugs 4 to 6 weeks to kick in." And Woody lasted another week. And I had not. I was out of town again on a business trip, and I had not heard from him. So I asked my dad, could he go and check? Because I'm thinking, oh, Woody was just having trouble sleeping, and I'm thinking maybe he fell and hit his head or something like that. And I will never forget the call I got from my dad at about 9 o'clock, 8:30 at 9 at night, calling, telling me, it's bad, it's bad. And I'm like, what do you mean it's bad? And he's like, Woody's dead. And I'm like, what? And they're like, he's hanging. And like, none of this, I mean, clearly the shock of something like that, but none of it like even registered, like, what? How could this be? And literally that night, my dad then called, you know, my sister and her husband over and my mother, everybody came over, and the coroner had asked if Woody was on any drugs. And I'm like, I don't know. It's something, I didn't even know what it was. And it was, you know, because thinking we're both responsible adults, thinking like it's no different than an antibiotic or something. And they said, oh, is it? Because it was literally, there was no note, but this bottle of Zoloft was sitting by the back door. It was almost as if that was his note. And the coroner said, ooh, this, we're going to take the drug with us. It might have had something to do with his death. And I remember my, you know, obviously I'm in Detroit trying to get myself back to Minneapolis. And my brother-in-law that night literally put in the word Zoloft and suicide in Google, and all this information came up, including your book, the Antidepressant Fact Book, which was ordered that night. And literally learning all this stuff about 1991, there were hearings. But at this time, there was no, you know, actual warning. So meanwhile, you know, a week later, my life had just fallen apart. We had his funeral, and my brother-in-law stayed up almost, I don't think he even got any sleep for a good week or so, and came to me and said, Kim, I think I figured out what happened to Woody. And literally, it almost, that experience catapulted me into this work, because intuitively I knew my husband. There's no way none of this made any sense. You know, all the suicide groups, and I actually went to one, and it was almost, I'll never forget, it was a support group, and she kind of patted me on the head and said that this might, she goes, oh, we never saw it coming. He was depressed. I'm like, no, I'm like, I know he was, like, I know there's something here. And so many of those people in that support group, looking back, all had the same thing. They never saw it coming. It was like, that it was like within weeks. And so, literally we, start researching everything. I actually sent your wife a picture of the my book from 13 years ago that has all the blue tabs, that because those pages, and the whole book is full of highlights, but those were the pages that really was like, oh my God, that's exactly what happened, and how did other people know, but it wasn't put out in the public into warnings yet. And you know, at that point when Woody was on this, these drugs were advertised like crazy. You know, it's the little white M&M, kind of, you know, looked very benign and said, you know, if you're, are you sad? You sometimes get lonely. Do you have a hard time being in crowds? You might have social anxiety and only your doctor may know. You know, so all this stuff started bubbling together, and, really one thing led to the next, and the FDA's, oh, and the other thing I forgot to mention, ironically, the day Woody was found, the front page of the Minneapolis Star Tribune had an article that said the UK finds link between antidepressants and suicide in teens. So all of this kind of perfect storm happened, literally the day he was found. So I still can't believe 13 years later I'm still working on this, but it ignited something inside me, because obviously it was too late for us. But imagine, you know, once you start really going into this and hearing all these 91 hearings and watching footage of testifying, and I feel like it's the perfect crime that the companies can get away with and always blaming the victim. You know, oh, they were depressed. Oh, they must have had this. You know, it's always somebody else's problem, but it's never, you know, the drug. And it's like, the again, I keep saying, it's the perfect crime.
It's,
so that's a little background in how I got into this work.
Wow. How soon did you become an activist after your husband, after Woody's death?
I would almost say immediately. You know, obviously I had to have, you know, had to go through some of the funerals, some of the initial grieving, or not even, this was part of my, huge part of my healing and grieving was doing the research. But literally I would say within weeks, maybe a month after we met with a law firm out in California, went out there. I didn't realize they had documents talking about that were from Pfizer's chief, with the chief safety officer, Dr. Roger Lane, and it was an authority from New Zealand writing into the FDA or to Pfizer asking about that they had GPs who had patients on 50 milligrams saying they stood outside their bodies looking in. And that was identical to what Woody said. And his response back to the authorities was, oh, it happens in all SSRIs. We don't know why. So when we went out and saw that document, and we, you know, pretty much signed up. I mean, it was a venture that I never thought in a million years I would be involved in a lawsuit. But it really became something about making sure that, you know, it was too late for our family, but if there's anything we could do, then I was going to do whatever it took, and literally started going out to D.C., even just all of, like, taking your book. That book came many times, and I have many copies of photocopies from different pages, articles, and then we're bringing binders out to the FDA. And then in I think it was February, you'll probably remember this, February 2004, I think is when the FDA held their first antidepressant hearing in teens. So we went out, testified there, met a lot of amazing families who unfortunately learned the hard way like our family did, but we also started connecting. And then I think eventually in later in 2004, they put the black box warning on for kids. And then, you know, meanwhile, you know, my lawsuit was going on. And one of the things that was shocking and what I continue to learn through is how corrupt the whole system is. There was the chief attorney, so basically the chief counsel for the FDA had, had just gotten into his position at the FDA. But before that, he was working at a private law firm and had received $300,000 of money from Pfizer. And we were able to work with Representative Hinchey to expose it, to expose the fact that he got this money of $300,000, because what he was doing on behalf of the FDA, but really on behalf of his old clients, is he was intervening on behalf of the FDA with these briefs called preemption briefs that they're still using today, which basically is, even if the drug company or device company wanted to warn, the FDA wouldn't let them because they didn't find it. They are the ones that are the authority on the warnings, which is basically just a legal maneuver. But anyway, so, you know, I started getting involved in some of these things, kind of seeing like, why am I learning about this after the fact, and how people have no idea how political our system is to even get a drug or a device on the market. So literally, I just threw myself into this. And as I said, I think it was really part of my healing, because I felt like the whole thing was so out of my control that I was doing what I could to do what I could, even telling his story. And I say that all the time when I get contacted. Unfortunately, it's such a problem that's still happening.
Wow. It's amazing that you were able to do what you did in overcoming the paralyzing effects of grief with your energy and your desire to save other people, other families from these tragedies. Do you think that the public in general is more aware now?
No, you know, it's funny. I was just asked that question by somebody in the media that said, you know, everybody knows antidepressants have these issues. And I'm like, no. Actually, I think the rates are going up higher, right? And I feel like Woody's story today, 13 years later, is actually in some ways more relevant than it was back then. You know, back then we didn't have, none of us that were in that area, you included, we didn't have social media, right? We didn't have Facebook. We didn't have Twitter. We didn't have this ability other than more probably just the traditional, you know, a newspaper, internet with a link. You know, so we didn't have those tools that in some ways we didn't weren't able to amplify our voices. And I think today I get contacted. In fact, I get just was contacted last week by somebody, again, got it for was going through a divorce and the father killed himself. And it was like, you know, there's all these things that I, you know, people contact going, how come I never knew? Like, I found your story. And so I feel that it is just as relevant today, and again, probably more so as more and more of these drugs, because, you know, the antidepressants are kind of old news in terms of, you know, they're generic. But there are, you know, the Abilify, the ones that are on patent now that are being advertised that are, you know, even actually say, have you been on antidepressant for more than 6 weeks and you're still depressed? You may need to add. So it's basically another drug to put on top of. So I think we just need a whole new awareness about the dangers. These are not just benign, happy pills that we're meant to take as vitamins, you know,
yeah,
the rest of
our
life.
More, Kim, I use the term neurotoxins. And if you actually look into the neurotoxin literature outside of psychiatry, you'll find them studying lithium and studying antidepressants and studying the antipsychotic drugs, because all these drugs are really strong neurotoxins. So it's no surprise they do far more harm than good. What would you expect from a neurotoxin?
Yeah.
It's such a fraud. It's such a huge, huge fraud. How did you get involved finally with with the FDA? How did you get onto the FDA Psychopharmacology Drug Advisory Committee, the collection of bad guys, mostly guys, who work with the FDA to make sure the drug companies come ahead of the consumers? How'd you get onto that advisory committee?
Well, it's funny. I've been, like I said, I've been doing this work for many years. And you had mentioned in the opening about a coalition that I work with, which is basically a group of organizations that work on consumer and public health issues, like Consumer Reports, Public Citizen, different organizations that really care about reforming and, you know, looking at how drugs are approved and devices are approved and trying to reform the FDA. So basically, through that process, I've been to meetings at the FDA with the commissioners.
Name that group again. Is that the Patient, Consumer, and Public Health Coalition?
Correct, yes. And
the Patient, Consumer, and Public Health Coalition. Can somebody Google that and they'll get there?
Yeah. Yep, and I was just going to say, I think it's patients and consumer. I'll find out the. There is a website that has the list of the organizations.
Yeah, and they can find you too. We're
yep.
talking with
yes.
Pat, with Kim Witzak, WITCZAK. Yeah, so go ahead with. So you were working with this group, and that was an inroad to getting on the committee.
I believe so. Yeah, you know, I've had over the years, I've met with several of the FDA commissioners. In fact, it was after I testified in front of the U.S. Senate during 2007 when it was Commissioner von Eschenbach. Afterwards, we were both on one of the he was on the opening panel, and I was on the second panel with two other former commissioners. And it was really talking about FDA issues and drug safety issues, because what I found during this whole process is it wasn't just an issue with our antidepressants, which I thought it was when I got into this work. It's really an issue with our whole approval process and how the FDA works and how the companies use things and uses the FDA and Congress, et cetera. So at that point, von Eschenbach had invited me to be a patient representative on the committee. But what I realized is patient representatives are only used by law. They don't have to be on the committee. They don't have to use a patient on the committee. And you may or may not, they may or may not use one at every advisory committee. But eventually, through that process, I never served. But, you know, obviously, they were familiar with me. And there was an opening on the consumer representative or on this committee, the Psychopharmacologic Drugs Advisory Committee, as a consumer rep. And to me, that felt more appropriate because as a I wasn't technically, in my mind, the patient is usually somebody who might have the disease or whatever the area of the committee's work. I felt I was more, it's more appropriate that I represent kind of the consumer or the public, the real world experience, as I like to say. And I, like you, was kind of a little shocked because, you know, most of these advisory committees, and I've been to a lot of these committees, the consumer rep usually votes in favor of the drug approval. And this one, I was, you know, for me, if it's really about the evidence, right? And if it's there, it's one thing. But if it's not, that's another thing. And I am... You know, I've only, this was my first year as appointed on this committee, and I've only had one meeting where I was actually on the committee as the consumer representative earlier this year. And it was a pretty lonely place sometimes to be. You know, as you mentioned, many of these, and they're usually men, but they, for the most part, a lot of the drugs, it's almost like these advisory committees are really the precursor for an FDA approval, although the FDA does not have to follow their advice, but they're, you know, and I'm putting in quotes, experts. So they might be, you know, a lot of them from academic centers or psychiatrists, but I've always said that these committees need a GP, a general physician, because that's where a lot of these drugs are being written, and somebody who understands the real world, but not like it almost feels like these committees are usually stacked with people who have a bias towards approval or a bias towards drug. You know, that's kind of, they use a lot of drugs. And I'm always shocked when I go to these meetings and they get approved. And then afterwards, when they go around and say their comments, they will say, well, the evidence wasn't really that robust or it wasn't that strong. And I think to myself, then why did you vote yes? Because if it's not there, then you're better off to vote no and then have it in the record for your rationale, as opposed to, you know, I think back to the advisory committee in 91, which I'm sure you were probably at some of those hearings back when it was just Prozac. And I think, fast forward all these years later, and your name was on something that had issues that you should have done the right thing back at the time it was at and before the committee. So, anyways, I vote with my conscience.
And you've been on one, and then there was another they didn't quite let you be on. Tell that story.
Yes. So the one earlier this year was on a new drug for Parkinson's psychosis to do with hallucinations. So that was the committee. And we can, you know, I can tell you stories about that one separately. But this one was just a couple. It was back in October, just a month ago, and it was for Chantix, which is the anti-smoking drug. And this was the second time the Pfizer was coming before the FDA's advisory committee asking for the black box warning for neuropsychiatric side effects to be removed. And so it's and it's very interesting to know the backstory on that because, you know, Chantix has a Pfizer made Chantix, and they had, when it first came out, there were all these similar in some ways as some of the events as the antidepressants, where there were random, you know, suicides, violence, et cetera. So they ended up having big lawsuits, right? So anyways, interesting, after Pfizer shut all those victims up in their negotiations of the lawsuit where they could never tell their story in public again, that's when they came to the FDA saying, hey, we've got some new study that we've been doing over in Europe and some other observational studies. Let's try to get the black box warning removed, which, you know, is basically sales. So they came. I was supposed to, you know, I had already received all the information from the FDA, and my travel was all booked for the trip, and 5 days before the hearing, I got a call or an email actually from the FDA saying that I had been disqualified from participating in this advisory committee Chantix due to an intellectual bias. So, of course, it felt like somebody broke up with me over a text. So I was like, well, you have to have a conversation. Like, I can't just accept that at face value. Like, oh, okay, great. You know, I'm, you know, disqualified. So I asked to have a conversation with them. And the day before I was supposed to fly out, I finally actually had a call with them. And there were seven people from the FDA on this conference call with me to explain to me why I was recused from serving. And, you know, I kept asking who the people were, who did it eventually go to, like who was the final say that told me I couldn't participate? Because, you know, they have before every advisory committee, they do a screening on conflicts of interest, and financial conflicts has been what they had screened for. And they also, something I didn't know, that if you had a financial conflict 366 days ago, you wouldn't have to put it on your form because it's only from 365 days. So it's really interesting that it had been only financial, and now they're starting to ask things that would give you like this intellectual bias.
Write letters of forgiveness for multiple members of the committees because multiple members have got money from drug companies and the FDA to avoid getting sued, or these people to protect them from getting sued, gives them a letter of forgiveness. When I came upon that, when I was working on talking back to Prozac and was the psychiatric expert for all the Prozac suits, I couldn't believe it, that there were all these conflicts of interest. And so they all got a letter forgiving them the conflicts of interest and allowing them to continue. But you, they weren't going to give you any letter of forgiveness.
And trust me, I tried. I said, you know, I could still, you know, ask. I said, well, I would still show up and I can be on the committee, but I just won't vote. Because in my mind, it's really not about the vote per se. It's more about the questions you get to ask. And so and they said no. They had thought about that, and the answer was no. So the other guy that this has happened to as a consumer rep was almost the exact same thing with the intellectual bias was Sid Wolf from Public Citizen. So the two of us have had this happen. But anyways, at the end of the conversation, when they tried to they gave me all their rationale, I finally said, okay, I have one last question. Can I, since I already missed the deadline because I thought I was going to be on the committee, would I be able to have 3 minutes, or can I have a slot in the open public hearing to come and make comments? And they said, oh, you'd still come? You'd still come out here? And I said, yes. They put me on mute, which I would love to have been a little, I would love to have been a little, like, you know, fly on the wall in that conversation. And then they came back to me and they said, yes, we'll give you a slot, but just know that we're going to introduce the conflict of interest at the beginning of the meeting, saying that there's a member of the committee who was recused from serving, but they didn't say why. So when I actually got up there to do my 3 minutes, I was able to say why I had, you know, basically got recused because I had a lawsuit for an unrelated drug against Pfizer 10 and a half years ago that was resolved. So it was just, you know, I wanted to make it sure that people heard. And then I was able to ask and say the kind of questions. You know, it wasn't certainly by any stretch of the imagination, was it the same as had I been on the committee, I would have asked more poignant questions. But, you know, I still showed up because I felt like I had to show up because I know that, you know, Pfizer shut up 2,700 people that I've had conversations with, but they can never tell their story in public, ever. Because they, and granted, they signed it, you know, kind of blame the lawyers too. But, you know, I just, knowing that they did this and how it politically happened. And I also feel, and because the removal of a black box warning is pretty much, as the FDA stated in that hearing, is an unprecedented move. They've done it one time before for some cancer drug, and it didn't have the, once they had, you know, had more research, they realized it didn't have the same kind of effects on the liver or something, so they removed it. But something like Chantix, for me, is a mass-marketed drug. It's one that's heavily advertised. You know, the patents are going off soon. When a drug has a black box warning, which is the most serious, as you know, serious of warnings, including death, there's restrictions on advertising and what you can communicate and how you can communicate to the public. So it's a big deal if you got to remove that. And so I also feel like there's a lot of groups out there, a lot of the, and I call them AstroTurf patient groups, basically kind of fronts for the drug companies or the device companies. They're, you know, like National Alliance for Mentally Ill and some of these that get a lot, they supposedly represent the public and patients, but they get a lot of money from the companies to go out there. And usually at these hearings, the sad thing and the truth of it is the patients that they tend to hear from are the patients that the industry actually flies in so they can tell their story. So it's not really somebody who's the patient. So anyways,
let me interrupt for a second and just orient people to Chantix. It's a chemical name, varenicline. This is a smoke cessation drug, so it's being given to a wide range of people, not necessarily to suicidal or violent people. And Chantix, per prescription, has the highest rate of violence reported of all drugs to the FDA, even more than the antidepressants, which are right up near the top. It's by itself at the top. It has an infinitely larger number of reports than your average drug at the FDA, which has one or two reports or no reports of violence. It's got, I forget the numbers, but they're very large. And a published study by Tom Moore and Joe Glenn Mullen on violence, and you can just put in, just Google Thomas Moore violence FDA, and you'll get the studies. So here we have a real epidemiological study of reports to the FDA per prescription, and the drug clearly has a greater association with violence than any other FDA-approved drug. And that's the one they want to remove the black box warning from. They should have never held hearings at all. It's ridiculous. And they voted to remove it, right?
Yeah, they voted, and they voted to remove it, even after they all said, well, maybe the evidence. But they did vote to remove it, and the FDA is supposed to rule on it in the next month or so. But it's going to be a very interesting kind of slippery slope in my mind because, you know, as we know, we've heard suicide rates are going up with teens. And even I had a conversation with somebody from the National Alliance for Mentally Ill last week at the FDA, and they had mentioned, well, you know, suicide rates are high. People aren't taking their antidepressants. They're scared to take their antidepressants. And he was talking specifically with teens. We don't really know why, but and so I have a feeling, this is just it's an intuition. I don't have any evidence of it, but I just have a feeling this is almost like testing the water of, you know, the power of advocacy groups, patient advocacy groups coming forward, like the smoking cessation groups. These were big organizations, you know, the big, as a public health, you know, they're representing public health. It came, put a lot of pressure on the FDA that these black box warnings on Chantix were scaring people, that they're, you know, that the public health of somebody who smokes is a lot greater of a risk than the potential of an adverse event from Chantix. So I just have a feeling the same conversation is going to come before the FDA with maybe some of the antidepressants that all have a black box warning. I wouldn't be surprised. It's like I said, it's an unprecedented area, and we'll see what the FDA rules. I mean, hopefully, you know, maybe they'll do the right thing on this one and keep the black box warning because of what you said, you know, Tom Moore's study. And it's the FDA. And one of my points to the FDA at that committee is if you're going to ever remove a black box warning, you got to look at all evidence. And that means patient reports. So, you know, they had more reports into the FDA through their MedWatch program, which is the system at the FDA where people can report issues with their drugs. So they had that. You know, you have studies like what Tom Moore did. You had these 2,700 victims of lawsuits that you didn't hear their stories. So I feel like you don't just take a study that had a company objective from the get-go, which was to get the black box warning removed.
You're good. Listening to Kim Witczak, WITCZAK, extraordinarily informative. That's quite an insight into the direction you think they're going in. I haven't looked into this. It makes complete sense, though. And as soon as they approve removing this black box, they're going to be inundated. They are opening a Pandora's box. They're going to be so bombarded by drug company money from millions of directions, including through Congress and the White House. It's just going to be amazing. The corruption, yeah. Folks, is just, it's hard to bear looking at. It's not just around these issues. I think it's particularly bad in the psychiatric area, though, because so much money is involved and because the drugs are so worthless and damaging and nonsensical that the only way they can keep them afloat is with drug company propaganda, drug company intimidation, drug company buying people, and so on. So I think it's particularly bad, but it's a microcosm of the macrocosm of government corruption, which is just enormous in every way. I think I introduced my last show talking about going to a conference put on by Pam Popper and hearing people talk about the issues of nutrition and the corruption, again, that goes into pushing dairy products and pushing meat products and in excluding and shutting down critics of those powerful industries. And I think we all probably remember they went after Oprah over hamburger. That was a mistake. She won. But the ordinary citizen could never fight back being sued for libel, you know, for criticizing meat products. So, wow. It's just a lot to confront, and you've been very brave and courageous. Kim, and I want if worst comes to worst, and indeed they start to consider modifying the other black box warnings, or I want you back on the show immediately to talk about it and alert us.
Absolutely.
There's so much more we can talk about. We have about probably 12 minutes left or so. We had talked beforehand about the drug, and you mentioned it briefly, for psychosis in Parkinsonism. I'd also be interested just in knowing more about these committees that you've gotten yourself aligned with. You're on the board of directors of the National Physicians Alliance. Tell us more about that.
Yes. It's funny, through all the work and being in Minneapolis, I have found that because I'm not part of the system out in D.C., and I say the system, but being on the ground to kind of know what's happening at every, like, move on the Hill and Congress, and through that, really hooking up with an amazing coalition of supporters and people, because they realize that, you know, there are people who do it every day as lobbyists or activists and whatnot, but to have the stories, and I tell people all the time when I get contacted, be willing to share your story, because the power of people realizing, A, they're not alone, that what happened to them, they're not alone, and B, it really helps to move some of these agenda items, because it's very political. And National Physicians Alliance is a D.C.-based nonprofit, a progressive physicians group. And, you know, I've always said it's really important that we have physicians. And a lot of the people, they have members of all specialties, but they have a belief of not taking pharma, any money from the companies. So they're neutral. You know, they don't have that influence of industry money. And again, being I'm a consumer rep, it's really a physicians group. It's been somewhat for me, getting over the idea that I don't have any letters behind my name, because I've seen that very much when I've gone to a lot of these conferences. They quickly glance over somebody like me because I don't have like a PhD or a JD or an MD, any of these numbers. So it's really great that I've been aligned with this the physicians group of National Physicians Alliance. They do great work. One of the things that we keep hearing, even when we've met at the FDA with the commissioner's office, they will say, we never hear from doctors, or the only doctors that we hear from are from the other side. So we're not hearing from doctors that have the same concerns you do, and which is really interesting to me, because it really shows you the amount of money that is in the system and the power of the money and who is getting these meetings. So it was, I'm really pleased to be a part of them. They do great, great work on a lot of different issues, and especially now with our new election, and to kind of see what happens with some of the social and health justice. They don't do all drugs, but they're really concerned. They have an entire FDA task force. And really being the voice of the physician, because, you know, physicians carries a lot of weight. It really does. You know,
oh,
it's
my
a responsibility.
God, yeah. Did you follow at all the recent approval of electroshock treatment for depression by the FDA without testing? Did you keep track of that at all over the years?
I haven't. So here's what I've learned through all my advocacy work, that I thought drug approvals were bad, but I actually found that and learned that device approvals are even way worse. It's a wild west that they don't even need to have approvals, and they can get approved. It's called the 510K process, if anybody wants to look it up online. But it's really, it just needs to have something that's a predicate on the market, so it never has to have testing on people. It's amazing. So we are guinea pigs.
There's overwhelming evidence of brain damage. You're You're passing a 900 milliamp current through the brain. You're causing convulsion and coma. That's per se is brain damage. Yet they're approving it as safe and effective for depression without testing either the safety or the effectiveness. It is bizarre. And the one thing I liked about that, though, is it really indicates how corrupt the process is. If you can approve something that is obviously grossly damaging to the brain and mind, that is that meets all the criteria of repeated concussions, but only much worse than concussions or seizures per se, because the person actually goes into a coma and flatlines, the EEG flatlines. Now, I'm laughing because it makes me anxious and enraged that, that they're so corrupt. And they heard from organizations who were against shock treatment. They had more letters sent to them, I think 10,000, talking about people being harmed by the treatment. They had a published article by me that that was a part of my submission to them. It's just bizarre. The corruption, folks, is beyond belief. And that at least is one of the good things that came out of shock being approved, because how can you possibly not know that an organization, a federal government organization, is corrupt when it approves something that every layperson knows has to be brain damaging and which so many people have seen with their own families? It's a disgraceful situation. But, you know, life has always been tough. There's always been corruption. Read the Bible. It's all about corruption and people fighting corruption. And bless you, Kim Witzig, for being one of those folks that's been brave enough. Has it gotten pretty scary at times?
Well, I will say when being at the on the FDA panel, that makes me a little sometimes nervous or testifying when I realize I feel alone. But the one thing I've always said is, and, you know, my parents are like, are you ever nervous? And I go, not really, because I feel like I have I have truth on my side. I've never, if you go back and look at anything I've ever done in the 13 years, stories never wavered. I'm not the one that has to think, did I cross my T or dot my I? Or what did I say last week? What did I say 2 years ago? And, you know, I feel like there's so much of that. But, you know, I know that it's big business. I will never forget when I, back when Senator Grassley was really involved in investigating all the financial money connections between the universities and the drug companies, his chief of staff was attacked. And one late night, and, you know, it was just too ironic because it was right when things were happening. I do believe that there's probably people who have big powers. I do find this is a good example of how influential, like during my legal depositions, the first part of my whole deposition with Pfizer, all they wanted to know was who knew what where. That's all they didn't even ask me about Woody. It was not until like several hours into my deposition when I actually said, can I ask you a question? And they said, no, we're the ones asking questions. I said, okay, I will say it for the record. I don't know what this line of questioning has to do with my husband being dead. You haven't even asked me a question about him. And they wanted to know, like, who knew what. They know it's a big, big business.
Yeah, and they were looking for who to depose and harass.
Yeah, totally.
And hopefully to catch you in a contradiction or something.
Yep, completely. And I remember they did actually, somebody went to my next door neighbors during this whole time and asked about Woody. And they asked if he, and they're like, well, you know, and so they were trying to like, so they learned that Woody liked to sweep our driveway because he was pretty anal and he was, you know, the son of a military colonel and he's just very clean and organized. Nothing that would ever make you think anything other than an organized guy. And in fact, I wish I was more organized. But anyway, so during the deposition, they're like, well, do you think he has OCD tendencies because he swept his driveway? And I'm like, what? Like, I just almost laughed at it because I was like, where did that come from? And I found out that they were talking with my neighbors.
Yeah. You never felt personally threatened yourself in any way or personally publicly humiliated by these vast powers? I now call it the pharmaceutical empire because that's what it is, folks. It's an empire, and it particularly rules in America. It's particularly powerful in America. We're down to 1 minute.
I do have one story. Okay. I do have one little story. Can I tell you this one?
A minute.
Okay. So it was right after the testifying at the U.S. Senate, and we went to pick up our bags up at Senator Dodd's office, and he said, just want you to know that the NAMI, National Alliance for Mentally Ill, came by with, went to every senator's offices with your written testimony and said not to believe me because I was a Scientologist. And I was like, what? That couldn't be further from the truth. So that was my first time that I actually really saw this entire really undermining, because clearly they were asking me questions in the Senate about ideas I had, and that this was a way to discredit me. So that was a first time, and we put that one pretty much to bed, but that one was a shocker to me. And maybe not for people who've been
involved.
NAMI
dances to the tune of the pharmaceutical empire. I blew the whistle on their funding decades ago. And it goes on and on and on. Kim Witsak, thank you so much for being on the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. You lift my spirits that there are folks like you out there speaking truth to power. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you'll be on again, Kim. Bye-bye now, folks.
Great. Bye. Thank you.